when Thoreau was behind bars for civil disobedience. Emerson, what are you doing behind those bars? Yes. And Thoreau's question to Emerson, what are you doing outside those bars?
Yes, that's similar.
Mother, what's the matter?
Yes. Then it's the more terrible kind of madness that haunts, because, you see, it's not easy to carry all this all this with you, whatever other things there are. That's awfully the line about his wife, "Oh, my petite, clearest of all God's creatures, still all air and nerve." It's an awfully contemporary moment in a love poem, I think. Then all the rest of it, he's very glad when he gets in his friends. You see, when he gets in Philip Robb, they outdrank the Robbs in the heat of Greenwich Village, fainting at your feet. He was too boiled and shy and poker-faced to make a pass.
This then clearly autobiographical.
Yes. Quite. No, the whole book is, and as a matter of fact, in the middle of the book, there is a fragment in prose, an autobiographical fragment, he calls it, in which he does talk about the Lowells of Boston, what he remembers of his father and what he remembers of his relatives, do you see?
But he's of the Brahmin family, then, isn't he?
Of the Brahmin family. And this is he's made this into legend, too, do you see? This has been a vantage point for him.
To speak, then, we'll hear Lowell once more. To speak of woe that is in marriage.
Yeah, that.
It is the future generation that presses into being by means of these exuberant feelings and supersensible soap bubbles of ours. Schopenhauer. The hot night makes us keep our bedroom windows open. Our magnolia blossoms, life begins to happen. My hopped-up husband drops his home disputes and hits the streets to cruise for prostitutes, freelancing out along the razor's edge. This screwball might kill his wife, then take the pledge. Oh, the monotonous meanness of his lust, it's the injustice, he is so unjust, whiskey blind, swaggering home at five. My only thought is how to keep alive. What makes him tick? Each night now I tie $10 in his car key to my thigh. Gored by the climacteric of his want, he stalls above me like an elephant.
That's a powerful last couple of lines there for a sonnet.
Yes, a sonnet.
Gored by the climacteric of his want, he stalls above me like an elephant.
Yes.
I'm thinking, as we listen to Lowell read, tomorrow night at Medina, Henry, this event for poetry, the variety, the different tempi involved, the different attitudes of the poets, all five will be so wholly different from the other.
Five different levels in every sense, voice levels, as technicians say here at the studio. But
maybe as a vital statistic, before we hear Kunitz, number five tomorrow night, Stanley Kunitz, tomorrow night at Medina, there are student, I believe, this is aimed primarily at many students, too, isn't it?
The prices are just as low as we can make them, at $1, $2, and $3, and the $1 and $2 seats are perfectly fine. The $1 seats are fine, because the place is made to surround you. You know, it's like an overgrown European opera house. You know, it surrounds the people on the stage. So there's every reason why a student who wants to come would be able to come.
And we'd say now, this being Friday, tomorrow night, to go right down there.
Go right down to Medina. You can get tickets.
If they want to get them today, can they get them today?
They could get them at Poetry today.
At Poetry. The offices of Poetry would be,
1018 North State Street.
1018 North State. You can go today to Poetry or tomorrow night.
But otherwise, tomorrow at Medina from 3 o'clock in the afternoon on, they can get the tickets.
3 on the box office open.
Yes.
And the readings begin at 8:30.
At 8:30.
At 8:30, the readings.
Yes.
Kunitz. What about Stanley Kunitz, another Pulitzer Prize man? What is his uniqueness?
Well, this time, may I quote myself, Studs, because I feel some identification with Stanley Kunitz's work. He was an enthusiasm of Harriet Monroe's and of Ivor Winters in the old days, and then Stanley sort of disappeared, just went underground. Oddly enough, he was, among other things, he always was a great teacher. He was teaching at Bennington and lots of other places. He was working at an encyclopedia of American writers, and he put everybody in but himself, so complete was his anonymity. And one of the thrills of my editorship of poetry, shortly after, I think I'd been there about a year, a packet of manuscript came in the mail, including The Thief, that I hope will be able to. Can we have Stanley read that in his own voice? And he thought he had to tell me who he was, you know. But he'd always been, as people say, a poet's poet. The poets have all known him. You know, the world of poets is a small world. There are just a few dozen who know each other and really know all about each other. And Kunitz's reputation had always been secure there. But it was one of my joys as an editor to bring out this group of poems in the February 1956 issue, a black-covered issue that Stanley says was the change in his whole career. Within a few months, he got the Harriet Monroe Memorial Prize that the University of Chicago offers. I was on the jury for that. And the Brandeis Award. And the book that it took, I have to say, though we're on the air, I have to say it took about 10 of us poets to write letters to Little Brown tell them that this book was worth publishing. That included Auden and Marianne Moore and Richard Wilbur and Lowell and all the rest. This book came out and it won the Pulitzer Prize.
It's a sad commentary, isn't it? Yes. This has to be done for a major poet.
It's dreadful. It's dreadful. And this fight goes on all the time. And this is what Poetry Magazine is involved with from month to month.
Perhaps a word about Poetry Magazine itself. How many years old now?
51 now.
51. Library of Congress. The second half of your
century. We're in the second half of the century. And I think it's nice to have these vigorous poets who are now doing their best work or even have their best work ahead of them. I think it's a nice way to start a new half-century.
I think it should be pointed out, too, Henry Regal, editor of Poetry, that the gathering tomorrow night, all these proceeds go for the sustaining of this magazine.
The sustaining of this magazine.
That is the oldest in the world, probably.
It is the oldest poetry journal in the world. And it's in the last 9 years, it could have gone under at any time, because we just live from year to year. We have no endowment. We're in the position of the man who simply gets a salary and has to live on that. And we never make quite enough from these benefits to survive the year, but then some little foundation in New York will help us out. Well, it's significant that in that time we published a Dylan Thomas issue, a Japanese issue, an Israeli, an Italian issue, a French issue.
Latin American, too? Have you had that yet?
Not in the last 9 years, but some 20 years ago we did.
Yes.
And all these things, I say, are possible. Now there's a whole generation of newer poets, most of whom have had their most important prizes from poetry in the last 9 years. That's what we're doing. I started to read about Kunitz.
Yes,
so may I,
please.
This is what I wrote for the jacket of his book. Stanley Kunitz seems to me to be one of the very best poets of his generation, and he's now at the height of his powers. He has two qualities that stand out for me. One is in his language, an extraordinary combination of toughness and polish, a classical strength. The other is his vision, which goes beyond the easier uses of irony and achieves the genuinely tragic.
And perhaps in hearing the thief is the genuinely angry, isn't it?
Genuinely
what,
angry.
What is the, this came about... Wasn't that
he had his
writing this?
He had his pocket picked in Rome.
Oh, that was it.
And out of this, he made a classic spiel, as you see. It goes through, it rings all the changes. There's a beautiful Baroque section where he describes the fountains of Rome. And it ends with his writing, the reason why he writes this poem, for money, rage, and love. Three good reasons.
Stanley Kunitz, reading.
In a Roman tram, where the famous Roman mob wrung from the bowels of the hippodrome, mauled into shape its many-elbowed god to fight for exit through its civil wars. Somebody Roman picked my pocket clean, a pagan and a Christian curse on him. Somebody Roman may he find tonight in the street of the serpents or the lion's mouth, strewn on a wine-soaked board, more than he reached for, more than cash, green trumpeters for whom the legions march through solid stone. Meanwhile, the Carthaginians play redskins in the ambush of the sea, to whom must be meted out the standard destruction. It is a heavy responsibility. Let the Ladrona sneer as the leathered fold yields him my haunt of years, the papers of a life I wanted lost, memos, addresses, the snapshot of a child to plague him through his alley nights until he begs for mercy for the thing well robbed. Worlds in my pocket older than his own, may they erupt on him like hissing gold, tooth of the pythoness, chimera's scales, stones of the temple and Isaiah's beard. Toss him, sweet furies, from Tarpeia's rock. more even than my purse, and that's no laughing matter. It is my pride that has been hurt. A fine Italian hand, with its mimosa touch, has made me feel blind-skinned, indelicate, a fool Americano touring a culture like a grand museum. People and statues, interchangeable shows, perception blunted as one syntax fails. Why am I here? Some 30 years ago, a set of lantern slides I saw at school of these antiquities gave me an image of the rare serene that brimmed my eyes, for nothing pleased me then in my legacy. But the past that tempted me, the frozen pure, was a pedagogic lie. All's motion here, and motion, like emotion, is impure. A flower flawed by mutability, religion by its ruins, and yet thereby more lovely and more graced, perhaps more true. Still the chariot wheels turn, the assassin motorcyclists charge, wolves prowl in the streets under arcades of bells, Tiberius grovels through his dungeon halls, dreaming of boy-sized fishes in his bath. Behind the balcony of the cardinal's palace, smelling the laureled Mamertine blood, a ballpate awaits his rhetorical cue, and the clouds drift through a triumph of broken columns. Pickpocket, pickthank music plucks the strings, for the rag Madonna with perdurable babe, most dolorously hallowing the square, where Caesar walks 3 steps to meet Bernini, whose sumptuous art runs wild from gate to gate, pausing in tiptoe joy, only to light a torch of fountains, to set his tritons dancing, or at a blessed facade, to cast up from his wrist a flight of angels, volute on volute, wing on climbing wing. In the middle of my life, I heard the waters playing. Mater Cloaca, feast thee well, I pray, on what has been subtracted from my fate. 10 days of lectures, 30 days abroad. In this excess that's Rome, I'll not mope long, wearing my heart less Roman than Baroque. Though, damn it all, I wish I'd lived in style, jogged in carrozza round and round the town, guzzled Spumante by the bucketful, bought wagons of daffodils to please my dear. Now that I face the moment and the loss, driven to language on the Ides of March, here in my blistered room, where the wind flaps my ceiling like a sail, a miracle, no doubt, to be left at that, I recognize the god's capricious hand and write this poem for money, rage, and love.
Stanley Kunitz, the Roman orator.
Yes.
Isn't it funny? Now that I face the moment and the loss, driven to language on the Ides of March, here he is, Mark Antony. Raging and orating, and through this, the picture of the glory that was, the grandeur that was Rome, the religion, the sculpture that is there, the power that was, at the same time, the fine Italian hand.
Yes, with the mimosa touch.
Yes. The fool Americano.
Yes.
His pride.
Yes.
So it's an oration.
Yes, I love it. And he goes in, and he gets everything in, too. You know, the teacher that told him first about Rome. Yeah.
Of course, it's a comic. And it's strange. It could come up to class as a comic.
Yes.
A comic hate.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. That takes the curse off the hate. Takes the curse off the curse. It's a curse poem, you know.
Curse poem. At the same time, almost a tongue-in-cheek, but yet not quite tongue-in-cheek. Yeah. Maladazione.
Yes, a real maladazione, exactly. Maladazione. Yes.
So there are then 5 distinguished American poets will be reading tomorrow. It's the first time, I believe, this combination, isn't it? The different paces, the different attitudes, different actors, really 5 different actors on that stage.
Yes, 5 different poetries, 5 different worlds.
5 different worlds. Tomorrow night at Medina. And perhaps in the time remaining, we should talk of our guest, of Henry Rago, the editor of poetry, and his new book that has been acclaimed, A Sky of Late Summer, new poems of Henry Rago that are published by Macmillan. And of this interesting Kunitz, Hayden Carruth says these are rare and beautiful poems by an exceedingly rare poet. I mean that Henry Rago, who began with a surpassing lyrical talent and a mind as quick as fish, has stood off the blandishments of his own abilities, which is a more particular way of saying that he's resisted the temptations of poetry. His poems are natural, sure, right, without one surrender to the siren of virtuosity. Hence they have a grace and a purity which come only to true things, and a trueness which comes only to tempered things. And in these splendid, writes Carruth further, almost unbelievable poems, Rago brings back the crystalline, aerialesque quality that poets 40 years ago considered indispensable. Compression without density, harmony without artifice. I find these poems continuously rewarding. And Henry, I think you can reward us too, perhaps by this morning, by reading a couple of the poems from your book. And perhaps as a preface to that, since you paid tribute to Kunitz, here's his tribute to you. This was a letter that came to poetry concerning Henry's new book, A Sky of Last Summer. Henry Rago's special gifts permit him to strike for the absolute as in an act of meditation and still to remain attentive to the surprises of poetry. Now, the best of his poems, of which The Knowledge of Light is representative, achieve an astonishing depth of simplicity. His poems have claritas. That's a special word. It means more than clarity, doesn't it? Claritas, the splendor of the true. Claritas means... Mm-hmm. Henry, would you mind then, perhaps Kunitz referred to, the knowledge of light.
This was one of a trilogy. It's the middle poem in a trilogy that begins with the title poem, A Sky of Late Summer, and it's followed by a poem called The Attending. All three were published as a separate book in Italy about 3 years ago with a beautiful Italian title that I thought the Italian translations were better than the English, but the Italian title was Conoscenza della Luce, Knowledge of Light. And this is the middle poem in that thing, and it's just about many things. It could epitomize everything I think about poetry, everything I know about knowledge, everything I know about the relation of the heart to the world. It's written in a series of aphorisms, very small things. I won't read the numbers because I think that's a bore, but there'll be a little silence between each, at the end of each one. The Knowledge of Light. The willow shining from the quick rain, leaf, cloud, early star, are shaken light in this water, the tremolo of their brightness, light sung back in light. The deep shines with the deep. A deeper sky utters the sky. These words waver between sky and sky. A tree laced of many rivers flows into a wide, slow darkness, and below the darkness flowers again to many rivers that are a tree. Rung from silence, sung in lightning, from stone sprung the quickening signs, lines quivered, numbers flew. Darkness beheld darkness and told each in each the depths, not darkness. To know, meaning to celebrate, meaning to become in some way another, to come to a becoming, to have come well. Earth wakens to the word it wakens. These dancers turn half dreaming each to the other, glide each from a pool of light on either side below the dark wings, and flutter slowly, come slowly, or drift farther again, turn to the single note lifted, and leap their whirling lines astonished into one lucidity, multiples of the arc, shapes of the heart. The year waits at the depth of summer. The air, the island, and the water are drawn to evening. The long month is lost in the long evening. If words could hold this world, they would bend themselves to one transparency. If this depth of the year, arch of the hour, came perfect to the curving of one word, the sound would widen quietly as from crystal, sphere into sphere, candor, answering a child's candor, beyond the child's question.
See now what Stanley Kunitz meant about still remaining attentive to the surprises of poetry. Answering a child's candor beyond the child's question. I think, Henry, if I may, and I take a whack at one of yours. This, I know, deals with your memory of teaching at the University of Chicago. the net, you call it. And you dedicated, you say, for my students at the University of Chicago, 1947-54.
Yes, those were the Hutchins years, or some of the Hutchins years, the great ardent college.
Has it to say about certain champagne? Those are the good years.
Well, I think
so, yes.
We're not
saying it was a bad years, but really saying it was certain traumatic years. And let's say more passionate years.
I have to say that. I think that's so.
I'll ask you about some of the references after the poem. Henry Ray goes, the net. A wide net I needed when that room leapt with words here to the left and there where I almost missed. Oh, the words were all the net there was. The walls faded, the room lithe as a net stirred, a wide, low shimmering. It was such poor thread as we had, tied upon thread. Speech crossed on speech, joined and secured, now gathering speech, the rich weight glowing. Hold now, hold, I had to shout each time. This that is all our doing, this that we owe one another. Hans, Yale, James, Bunny in her bright tears, Emmerich, Minda Ray, and the student always called sir, stray visitor from some remote class, with terms yet more remote, now held and holding forever with us this vivid morning. Hold, hold now, I cry still in a stillness, this such as it is that we have made all of us, and gather with what we made. Beautiful memory, isn't it?
Oh, thank you. It's a beautiful memory, and I'm pleased that you think it's something you'd like to read.
I'm thinking of some of these names you mentioned, some of the students. Hans?
Yes, Hans is Hans Matic, who had so much to do with Paul Crump, was one of the principal figures.
One of our most, I think, perceptive penologists today. And he, it's interesting that he taught so much to Crump. He gave Crump Moby Dick.
Yes.
Poetry.
Well, I have to say that one of the most thrilling letters I ever got in my life was shortly after I published something somewhere, and it was just at the time it was just at the time of the discussion of the Crump case, and Hans wrote me a long letter telling me that he had given Crump to read many of the books that I had given him to read in Humanities 3 at the University
of
Chicago.
Each of the other students you've mentioned have gone there.
Yale Kramer is an analyst in New York now, and Minda Ray is Minda Ray Sensabaugh, who lives in Israel now. And Bunny, alas, is dead. She was V.R. Lang, a very fine poet who wrote I, Too, Have Lived in Arcadia, was editor once for the Chicago Review, and then became a key person in the Poets Theater at Cambridge.
Yeah, I'm thinking, Henry, the time is almost up, but there's a way. I said the time is almost up. We look at the clock that seeks to be our master, but we'll try to buck it for a moment and at least have you read a poem, let's say a farewell poem for now from, let me just remind the audience, A Sky of Late Summer, poems of Henry Rago that are quite moving, and as Kunitz and Hayden Carruth both say, the element of simplicity, the splendor of the true is here, published by Macmillan, available now. And perhaps before you say goodbye too for now with a poem, to remind the audience about tomorrow night's big poetry reading.
Oh, yes,
the Big Five,
we'll
call
them.
Stanley Kunitz, Richard Wilbur, Robert Lowell,
Carl Shapiro,
and Brother Cunningham.
That's right.
A.V. Cunningham. Each one at the Medina, the Medina Temple tomorrow night, all proceeds to poetry. Henry, what's a farewell poem? As I'll say goodbye to you now.
Well, let's see. A poem for an anniversary. This is for Juliet, and that's really my wife's name. The epigraph for it comes from Dante, from the Vita Nuova. Questa cortesissima, this most courteous one. That's the most accurate description I could have found for her. Questa cortesissima. Poem for an anniversary. Mind and ear marveled now on this language. Immediately all and nothing ever studied. The chimes of its declensions, the courtesies poised in the verb, the clear idiom, though the use had faded, would instruct the breath against the pedant's guttural, not lost in the song but choked on the dry claims, and against the wit constricting its own life, open the lips and the throat to the child's exclaiming. Over the quarreling dialects twisted on one another, and the fragments and the syllables stunted or mute, the pure vowel open to sweet country and sweet air spoke with its whole breath from past to future, and trees, stones, beasts, startling to this lexicon, took new being in the names they had known forever, the old names falling away like dark encrustations. The earth shone as with its first rivers.